Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. I kind of want to do a Lost voice, like previously on Ridiculous Historians.
Wait a minute. Was that you doing the Lost voice, Ben?
Oh, man.
It's me, Noel, by the way.
You're Noel.
Uh-huh,
I'm Ben.
Me. Yep.
That's our super producer, Casey Pegram. And this is part two of our series on the heroic, innovative, and I would say extraordinary abolitionist, Benjamin Lay.
Yeah, when we last left our hero, he was starting off in his kind of radical protest career, doing things like beating people with tobacco pipes around the ankles, I imagine, getting thrown out into the mud, and then just laying there. So people had to step over his muddied body, and he would not be ignored, would he, Ben? He was pushing and preaching for the rights of enslaved people. At a time where that was absolutely not a popular thing to do, and it got him blacklisted within his own community of the Quakers. And as we're going to see, that really escalated.
And we have multiple stories of his protest. One Sunday, people living in a town near Philadelphia, Abington, Pennsylvania, were met with a bizarre sight outside of their morning Quaker gathering. The snow was thick on the ground, and Benjamin Lay, who was a member of that congregation, was there in the snow, not very well dressed.
Yeah, this is a weird one too, man. This guy was very creative in his protests. You have to give him that for sure.
There's a theatricality to it.
He was in something of like an assless chaps kind of situation, like a Cher or a Prince might wear. Mm-hmm. Only, you know, it was more like a one-legged trouser kind of thing,
yeah,
where he had a leg and a foot exposed. And as the congregants entered into their place of worship, they would say, "Hey, bud, you know, you're going to freeze to death out here. You're going to get real sick. Better cover that leg."
And he would turn to them and say, "Ah, you pretend compassion for me, but you do not feel for the poor slaves in your fields who go all winter half clad." So he's calling these people out and not letting them be comfortable in their, you know, again, I've used the word too often in this episode, but their rank hypocrisy. He also protested slave owners giving them no peace. As soon as somebody in the Quaker community who owned slaves stood up to talk at the meeting, at the religious gathering, he would jump to his feet and he would cry out, you know, "There's another slave master." I'm paraphrasing because
mm-hmm.
I'm yeah. not comfortable with the
no,
language.
No, he's using some strong language there. But it's, I think it's more meant to just be, I think it was just more of a term that was generally, you know, mm-hmm. used in those days for sure. But he is calling them out and saying, "There you are. I see you. You don't get to talk because you have no compassion for your fellow man." It all comes back to that. And yeah, he kept getting ousted. He was not a popular figure after, you know, causing all this ruckus at these meetings. And the elders, the church elders, I don't know if the ministers as well, started to get pretty peeved. And they actually appointed like a cop, a constable,
mm-hmm.
Constabulary, yeah, to keep an eye out for him. I mean, he was really making a splash. They had to hire a position just to keep him out of the meetings, and they'd toss him out into the cold night or afternoon or morning, whatever it may have been.
Whenever he showed up.
Who am I to say? And yeah, they would bar the door, and he was not allowed to return.
And one time when he was thrown out of a meeting house and it was raining, he went right back to the door of the meeting house and laid down in the mud. So everybody who left the meeting had to step over his body while he stared at them.
He's like something of like a combination performance artist
and
abolitionist protester. I really like this guy.
It's performance art for a good cause.
100%.
Finally.
As right? opposed to just like navel-gazing kind of pretension. Okay, sorry there's any performance art fans out there. I just don't get it.
I'm a fan of it. I like the weird stuff, you know. Also a fan of improv everywhere. I think he would have enjoyed that too.
More of a flash mob guy myself.
You're a flash mob guy.
No, I'm kidding. I do like Matthew Barney. That's performance art, some of it kind of, right?
What does he do again?
I don't know. He did that whole Cream Master cycle where he kind of like dressed up in as that weird like, you know, weird kind of like guy in a pink kilt and climbed all over the Guggenheim. But it's done for film. I guess is it only performance art if it's done like IRL, like with real people?
No, that's not fair.
Okay, then he's a performance artist. Yeah. I like Matthew Barney.
Well, something really weird that I got into that has nothing to do with this episode. I'm just going to show this to you.
Please.
Okay, this is a kind of dancing called butoh, or B-U-T-O-H, that is creepy and from Japan.
Okay, I'm going to try to describe this best I can for the listeners. Okay, there's a gentleman, looks that he has some sort of wedgie situation going on. He's wearing a cod piece. He's painted gray. He's hairless and bald and staggering around. Oh, he's kind of creatively falling. I love this. Looks like a Tool video.
Yeah.
Really does. Oh, now he's rolling down the stairs. The underwear piece appears to be something of a thong. I was correct about the wedgie now that I'm seeing the back. And now he's getting up slowly and then falling down again.
Like an angry, awkward, evil baby.
I dig this, Ben.
Yeah.
Okay. I take back everything I said about not liking performance art.
Well, maybe we just have to find the right performance. This stuff is creepy. There's a whole thing with it. Maybe
butoh?
Uh-huh. Maybe suitable for a different show. But yes, Benjamin Lay, performance art.
Sorry, really quickly. Is there a history to this or is this like a new thing?
There's a history.
We got to do a show about this.
Okay.
Let's do a show about performance art throughout history.
That feels like it could be its own podcast.
Maybe it could.
Yeah, let's give it a shot.
Let's give it a shot.
Let's pick some like really pivotal moments.
And then maybe we'll like spin it off. We'll spin off and do a whole other show.
Yeah. Casey, are you cool with that? You've got plenty of time, right?
All the time in the world.
Oh, man. Thanks. Will you help us do this performance art show?
Yeah, I'm a fan of Matthew Barney as well, so that's a good starting point.
Good stuff.
Yeah. One last thing, Casey, if you've got time. While we're rolling, if you want to get kind of creeped out, check out this butoh dancing while we're recording, B-U-T-O-H.
Cool. I'm going to do it.
All right. I want to hear what you think about it at the end. There will not be a quiz because I don't know enough about it. But performance art, back to Benjamin Lay. He keeps going, right, man? He has his shining moment coming up in 1738.
Oh, dude, he keeps doubling down. It's something referred to as the Berry Juice Massacre of 1738. I love that. It's so visual. September 19th, 1738, to be precise. This was 6 years after he had come to America for the first time. He just waltzed his way into one of these Quaker meetings in New Jersey, in a town called Burlington, which was a big meeting. It was one of the biggest events of the year, which is kind of weird because it was the Philadelphia yearly meeting of Quakers, but it was in New Jersey for some reason.
I mean, a lot of stuff happens in Jersey.
It's true, and it stays in Jersey, hopefully. Yeah, he wore a big coat with like a military kind of style decor, and he had a sword. And underneath it, he had a book with a secret compartment in which he had an animal bladder that was filled with a red juice of something called a pokeberry. You ever had a pokeberry, Ben?
I don't believe I have.
Is it like a razzleberry?
Hmm.
A pomegranate, perhaps?
You know, I don't know what a pokeberry is. Grapeish? Raspberry-ish? If you've had a pokeberry, write in, let us know. Actually, send us some recipes, too.
Well, the most important thing for our purposes and for Benjamin Lay's purposes is that it produced a bright, staining juice that he had stored, secreted away inside this animal bladder, hidden in this cutout, like sort of like you'd think of a, you know, prison contraband being hidden inside like a hollowed out Bible or something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I guess he wasn't banned from this particular meeting yet.
No, the heat hadn't gotten to Burlington yet.
Because he would have been, you know, pretty noticeable. People would have recognized him despite being disguised as a soldier, I guess.
In Philly, at least, yeah, because of his unique posture, too. So the way the Quaker meetings work is that there's no formal minister church ceremony. People speak as the spirit moves them, and so Lay waits his turn to speak. And when he finally rises to address this gathering of influential, moving and shaking Quakers, moving and shaking, yeah, that works out, he freaks them out because he announces, he yells at the crowd. He said, God Almighty respects all people equally, rich, poor, men, women, white, black alike. Slave keeping is the greatest sin in the world. How can you profess the golden rule? How can people who say treat others the way you wish to be treated, how can you of all people keep slaves? He then throws off his coat. This is like a Quentin Tarantino
climax.
He's
full nude. No?
He's got military garb.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And he's got this sword with him, and he's got this book. And then people are starting to think something might be weird. And he has this speech, right? Could you give us a reading of at least that line or that titular moment?
Oh boy, would I ever. This is like you're right. This is like a Tarantino-esque, like, you know, bust a cap kind of moment. Thus shall God shed the blood of those persons who enslave their fellow creatures. And with that, he raised the book aloft and stabbed it, ran it through with his sword. And the oozy pokeberry fluids dripped down his arm. People thought that he had stabbed himself, I assume.
I guess so, yeah. And then he threw this pokeberry blood on the slave keepers, and he said, all Quakers who fail to heed the prophet's call will expect physical, moral, and spiritual death. People go bananas, man. This is not what they signed up for.
Mm-mm.
You know what I mean? And now they don't know if the guy's actually bleeding. They're covered in blood. This is very much, you know, this is a protest. It's a little theatrical. It works, though. It's no secret, Noel, that I don't know about you, but I feel like it's very apparent to you and Casey both that a lot of times when I come in to record an episode, I'm hungry. And I always want to just sort of relate whatever we're talking about to food.
Yeah, it's true. You always look a little peaked, you know? Like I feel like you're picturing me as though I were a delicious roasted chicken, which, to be fair, is a shape that I resemble.
Oh, that's unfair, but a delicious idea. And while we're talking about delicious, let's talk about HelloFresh. You and I recently tried some HelloFresh.
We did, and there is a good reason why. It is America's number one meal kit, my friends, because they offer seasonal, easy recipes and pre-measured ingredients delivered right to your door. And all you and I had to do, Ben, was cook and enjoy. And we did both of those things.
That's true. That's true. And you'll never get tired of the menus you are sent because HelloFresh has 20 plus seasonal chef curated recipes every single week.
Yeah, and there's something for everyone. I chose the family style recipes that gave you bigger portions, or you can go calorie smart and even vegetarian and fun menu series like Hall of Fame and Kraft Burgers.
And I'll tell you what, man. I was a big fan of the pork and poblano tacos.
My favorite of the three, with the kiwi salsa, with the vine-ripe tomatoes, and I believe there was a nice onion and cilantro situation in there. It was delicious. I'd never thought of putting kiwi in a salsa before.
It's definitely opened up a whole new world for me salsa-wise, but you don't have to take our word for it. Get this, folks. Just for hanging out with us on Ridiculous History, you can get 9 meals with HelloFresh for free by going to HelloFresh.com/ridiculous9, the number 9.
Yeah, that's 9 meals for free with HelloFresh when you go to HelloFresh.com/ridiculous and the number 9 and using the code ridiculous9.
That's HelloFresh.com/ridiculous9. After he's done this, after he yells at the crowd and has that climactic moment, he just sort of shuts down. And he stands there. He doesn't say anything.
Just goes limp.
Mm-hmm. People surround him, and they haul him off from the building. He doesn't resist. He feels like what's done is done. He did what he came to do. And his life... Well, that's the thing. You know, if this were a biopic or if this were a fictionalized tale based on true events, we could say that that climactic moment led to a happily ever after. But unfortunately, we're not quite there yet because during this age of his protest and before his titular protest and after, he encountered a lot of hardship in his life, right? There was not a real happily ever after moment.
No, and it may well have spurred him on to, you know, really double down on these protests and try to get his point across. His beloved wife, Sarah, passed away in 1735, and the causes were unknown, and they had been together for 17 years at that point. And, you know, you could argue that this gave him time to really reflect and to really consider, you know, the legacy that he wanted to leave behind that would have also been a carrying on of his wife's wishes, you know, because they were kind of a team on this stuff. And he spent several years working on a manuscript of what would become the treatise called All Slave Keepers That Keep the Innocent in Bondage, Apostates. And it's a little bit strange, like in terms of structure, in terms of the type. It's hard to peg as what type of book it is exactly, because it's some combinations of like almost like biblical ranting kind of polemic prophecies, you know. It had curated pieces by other writers. It had some kind of firsthand accounts of what he witnessed in Barbados, though done with kind of almost a stylized dreamlike quality, I guess you could say. And then a part of it was also his autobiography, but really forward thinking, even in literature, like the way, you know, he would have been very out there to stray away from a traditional memoir or like treatise in that way, right?
Yeah, fragmentary differences in format internally and so on. He knew that the Quakers would never approve of this book, the Board of Overseers, rather. And he went directly to his friend. You know him, you love him. If you listen to Ridiculous History, the Benjamin Bond runs deep, because he went to Benjamin Franklin, who at the time was, I don't know, not ignoring the resurrection men in his abode in England. He was in the U.S. and he said, yeah, sure, I'll publish this. This becomes one of the founding key texts of the anti-slavery movement in the Atlantic, and it's seen as an important groundbreaking step in abolitionist thought. It is the most militant stand against slavery published up to that point.
Because I don't want to, like, you know, overstate the obvious, but I think it can't be overstated really how important printed word was in like changing hearts and minds. Like, you can throw, you know, sticky fake blood on people all day long and you're probably ultimately just going to piss them off. But when you really start laying your ideas out in a way that lots of people can understand and get their hands on, that's when ideas really start to spread. So he really did put his money where his mouth was and take it to the next level in terms of, you know, getting this idea out there. And he was absolutely revolutionary in that way, because no one else was kind of thinking quite like he was.
Or at the very least not going public.
Correct.
Their opinions.
Correct.
Right? So what's fascinating about this is that he comes along, he's a magnificent individual, comes along at the perfect time, because there's a generational struggle between Quakers over the specific issue of owning slaves and then still saying you obey the dictates or the teachings of the Quaker belief system. So by the 1730s, Quaker attitudes toward what has been called at times the peculiar institution, towards the owning of human beings, has begun to change. And Lay says repeatedly, he's not saying abolish the Quaker religion or anything. He's fighting against these hypocrites, and his most determined enemies are elders of the organization, who are also very wealthy, by the way, and others are ministers. He had fighting words for them, such as, time for such old rusty candlesticks to be moved out of their places.
Wait a minute. Old people being stuck in their ways and not wanting to move into the future?
Right.
That's crazy talk.
It was a weird time. It's a weird time now.
Yeah, it really is. But yeah, I mean, just like they didn't like it when he was, you know, disrupting their meetings, they didn't like it when he took that talk to the streets and to the people. They really didn't like it, because they considered him just a real troublemaker and did not like what he was putting down with the help of our boy Benjamin Franklin. So they disowned him. They essentially, I mean, I guess it's not called that in Quaker religion, but for all intents and purposes, excommunicated him from his faith, which he loved. And, you know, again, if you read more about Quakerism, all of these things make sense, like in terms of that they would be anti-slavery. So it just a lot of the tenets and the belief systems within Quakerism, it's all about being interconnected and being as one within the universe and, you know, loving your neighbor as yourself. Like you said, Ben, the golden rule, that to me is always the biggest sticking point when you're like, how can you say that you believe that and still hate people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing. He was right the whole time, but people didn't want to hear the unpleasant truth. Despite being disowned, he would still go to worship services and argue against the evils of slavery, but he became increasingly hermited away, and he started to live a life that might sound a little bit hippie to some of us and a little bit idyllic to others. He built his own home in Abington, that town we mentioned near Philadelphia, near a water spring. He made a cottage in a cave. He lined the entrance with stone. He had a library inside his cave home. He planted apple, peach, and walnut orchards. He tended a bee colony. He grew, you know, he had a garden with potatoes, squash, radishes, melons. He almost became a vegan, except for the honey.
I think that's even to this day a contentious subject within veganism. Am I wrong? Is it exclusively no go for vegans?
Well, none of the three of us are vegans, but I've heard it generate great debate too, because they're saying, well, are you still vegan if you eat any animal product under any circumstances? You know what I mean? But then again, I think there's some B12 supplements that some people have to take when they are practicing veganism, and those supplements may contain insect parts.
And like bee pollen too, right? That would be
That's a good question.
But it's true. So essentially let's just say he was a vegan for all intents and purposes, 200 years before anyone even thought of that as being a thing, let alone like a fashionable thing.
He says that he sees the presence of God in all living things, so he can't eat flesh because animals are God's creatures just as he is. He makes his own clothes to avoid the exploitation of the labor of others, and he boycotts everything produced by slave labor. He lives pretty well until about 1757. He's elderly at this point. He's 75, right?
Yeah, he's sort of in his twilight years. He's just, you know, spends his days tending his garden and making his own fabric and just kind of keeping himself busy. But then one day a visitor comes a knocking on his little cave door.
Yes, a group of Quaker reformers had recently undertaken a purification campaign. They called for a return to simpler ways of living, stricter discipline in the church, and a gradual end to slavery. All of this meant to appease a God they imagined was quite angry. Lay was told that the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, after a lot of back and forth and hemming and hawing, had started a process to discipline and eventually disown Quakers who traded slaves. Unfortunately, slaveholding itself was still going to be around for another 18 years in the community, but this was the first big substantive concrete step toward abolition. And how did Lay take the news?
It's a little hard to say. Initially, the reports that we've read in the Smithsonian Magazine article about the Quaker Comet indicate that he kind of a hush fell over him. And he took some time to really think about it, because he was obviously a really thoughtful, kind, reflective individual. And he's also like, you know, getting up there in years at this point. And then he gets up. He was sitting in a chair at the time. And assumes this pose of devotional reverence, according to this piece, and then speaks and says, "Thanksgiving and praise be rendered unto the Lord God. I can now die in peace." And then he instantly died. I'm kidding. That's not true.
Well, it definitely took a turn for the worse, right? This is such a weird moment to the way it's written, because it sounds like he says, "Thanksgiving and praise be rendered unto the Lord God." And then he just stands there for a while.
Yeah.
And then he says, "I can now die in peace." We don't know today exactly what led to his demise, But we know he asked to be taken to the home of his old friend Joshua Morris in Abington as his health deteriorated, and he passed away there on February 3rd, 1759, at the age of 77. History has vindicated Benjamin Lay. Like most Quakers in his day and age, he opposed the idea of carrying distinctions of class into the afterlife. So he's buried in an unmarked grave near his wife in the Quaker burial ground in the town of Abington.
And I don't know, Ben, you made the point that history, he kind of vindicated him. I mean, I think, you know, all it took to vindicate him was just realizing how on the right side of history he was from the start. And I think for him, it was meaningful that his people kind of vindicated him. But like, he never faltered and never really questioned his mission. And I think that's pretty inspiring, especially in this day and age where it seems like people are willing to flip and abandon their morals just, you know, on the drop of a hat. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty cool figure. And not to mention this idea that he's kind of a bit of a footnote in the history of abolitionism until pretty recently.
Yeah. He was re-embraced finally by the Quakers after almost 300 years had passed. The four groups linked to the original people who disowned him, excommunicated him from the Society of Friends, the Abington Monthly Meeting, the Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, the North London Monthly Meeting, and the Friends of the Southern East Anglia Meeting, released a joint statement recognizing the integrity and courage of a man who called slaveholders, including Quakers, to account, who protested the abomination of slavery, upheld the equality of the sexes, and lived his life with integrity according to his Quaker beliefs. And this statement, if you go to the end, says, "We hold that Benjamin Lay was a friend of the truth. We are in unity with the spirit of Benjamin Lay." As apologies go, or his acknowledgments go, that's pretty heavy.
That's a pretty good one, yeah. I would say. Yeah, yeah. I think it did the job. And you know, and again, even the historical record in terms of his influence on abolition, we're starting to see him kind of, you know, emerge. You know, at least with people that follow history, as a more, you know, noted figure. His biographer Benjamin Rush, who was an abolitionist himself and actually one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, this is his first biographer, by the way, referred to him as a Christian philosopher and said that, at least in Pennsylvania at the time, Lay was a household name. But as time went on, he started to appear less and less in these histories, in these discussions, and was kind of treated as sort of a kook. You know, and I could see how that could be, you know, kind of shoehorned into the narrative, considering some of the stunts that he pulled. But yeah, it started to kind of pick up steam, or at least in the record. And he was looked at as having suffered some sort of head injury. And this image of him as sort of an unreliable figure and sort of more of a crank really kind of held up.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And perhaps we end the story on this note. According to Benjamin Rush, you know, Lay was known to everyone in Pennsylvania. His portrait was in a lot of homes throughout Philadelphia. And he burned incredibly bright. And he shows us that one person can make a difference. And despite the fact that he has been excluded from so many abolitionist narratives, as they say in this Atlas Obscura article that we've referenced earlier, that we can finally give the title of, as Natasha Frost says in her article, "The 18th Century Quaker Dwarf Who Challenged Slavery, Meat Eating, and Racism, He Refuses to Be Extinguished from History."
Yeah, and I maybe mistakenly started to set it up as though he really did get his due historically. And I think, again, within people that really are familiar and want to do the work, you can find out about this guy. There are some resources, you know, about him, but he still largely isn't seen as like a central figure. Although, as we know, through his book and disseminating his ideas really did seem to turn the tide, at least within the Quaker community. By the way, which holds these tenets as the most important facets of their faith. And I think he is a steadfast example of all of these. Simplicity, peace, integrity, community, equality, and sustainability.
Agreed. So this concludes our episode, but not our show. No quister, no quister, no quister. That's what I say to myself. I feel like it's kind of like saying no whammies. Before
What is a whammy?
I don't know. I grew up.
Is that bankrupt? Is that when you go bankrupt in Wheel of Fortune?
It's from a game show.
No,
definitely.
It's Wheel of Fortune. They say no whammies on Wheel of Fortune.
Do they?
Uh-huh. Must be bankrupt.
I think it's from a thing called Press Your Luck.
You're right. No, Press Your Luck indeed.
I feel like the phrase no whammies has grown beyond Press Your Luck.
I think you're right, Ben.
Well, no whammies, no quizsters. So before we go, Casey Pegram, I want to check in with you real quick. Did you get a chance to look at some of that bizarre dancing?
Yeah, my YouTube recommendations will never be the same again. but it's great stuff. I was looking at a bunch of them, and it started to remind me of the series of films I'm familiar with. This Taiwanese filmmaker Tsai Ming Liang, who made a film called Journey to the West, where a monk walks as slowly as possible through crowded public spaces. And I Googled that along with Bhutto and found a text saying that one influenced the other. So, just the idea of walking very, very slowly, almost so that, you know, to the casual observer, you appear still. And then if you look long enough, you see that there is movement happening. But yeah, looks like some really interesting stuff.
That's so weird. I'm glad you guys enjoyed it and don't think it's incredibly creepy.
I'm a fan of the incredibly creepy and weird.
Likewise. So this concludes our episode, but not our show. Noel, you know, we like to keep the conversation going after the audio has stopped rolling. Where can people find us?
Oh, they can find us in the usual spots on the social medias or Ridiculous History. Is there a Ridiculous History show? And I think it's Ridiculous,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, the website. We have a website called Ridiculous History Show where you can also get some weird t-shirts.
Is it a .com, .biz, .gov?
It's a .com.
Okay, good. The old school.
Yeah.
You can find our Facebook group, Ridiculous Historians, on the Facebook, where you just have to answer a very simple question, which is either naming myself or Ben's name, and then you are in. Like Flynn, babies. And we participate in all kinds of conversations and memery and fun historical musings in that space pretty regularly. And it's a good group of folks. So come check out Ridiculous Historians on Facebook. If you don't want to do any of that and you want to just hit me and Ben up individually, because we are our own people, you can do so. I am on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown exclusively. I don't really do the Twitter. I'm more of a lurker.
I got hypnotized by this weird performance art, but you can still find me online on Twitter, where I'm BenBullenHSW, or you can find me getting into various sorts of shenanigans on Instagram, where I am going by very creative handle at BenBullen.
At least you locked it down, buddy.
is there a Noel Brown already?
No, I don't know. Maybe. I just
thought you liked the name that you got.
I do like the name. Yeah, I went for that immediately. Big thanks to super producer Casey Pegram, Alex Williams, who composed our theme, Christopher Hasiotis, here in spirit, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister, not here in spirit. He's more of a demonic cloud that sort of lurks over the proceedings.
And big, big thanks, of course, to Gabe Luzier, to Benjamin Lay, to Yves Jeffcoat, and to Matthew Now, the guy who just went on Ridiculous Historians and amended the score. I believe that we are 10-8 now.
In favor of
Quister.
Yeah.
Still.
We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.